Passion, pride and protest. A personal history of queer pubs. Episode 1. Passion.
They are essential. Queer pubs, queer pubs, queer bars, queer clubs are essential in our history because they're spaces where magic things happen. Where love and rivalries and arguments and whatever, snogs, first dates, they're the crucible where all of our wonderful things happen.
Once you're actually behind the door, you felt really special. You know, you felt like you were this kind of... you'd made it, finally, into a place where you could meet people like you. You know, you weren't just sort of sitting in your bedroom writing poetry about some woman who didn't fancy you. You were actually in a club with all these other people you could talk to and be open with about it. And also, you know, you might actually meet someone and could at least dance with somebody.
The chances to go and meet people and connect with people are made much easier in a pub. Also, having a pint or two definitely helps take the edge off things and, you know, eases those social interactions and increases our chances of meeting people, I suppose, and having a chat at the bar to someone. You never know who you're going to meet. They might be an idiot. They might also be your next great love, or both.
You know, it's a place where we meet friends, where we meet partners, where we break up with partners, where, you know, we dance the night away.
I've had straight friends complain to me about all the snogging and touching that sometimes goes on in kind of gay venues. And initially I saw their point, and then after a while I just thought, you don't really realise your privilege of being able to do those things, you know, hold someone's hand, snog them. You don't realise the privilege of being able to do those things in a pub or on any street corner without ending up in hospital.
It's 30 years or more since I first pushed open the door to a queer pub. I'd persuaded a straight friend to come along with me. After all, I didn't really know any other LGBT people. It was a Sunday night and we went to the Black Horse, or the Pink Pony as it was affectionately known, in central Brighton. We sat drinking pints of ale in the back room while a handful of lesbians argued over the pool table. I have a vague memory of there being karaoke on in the front of the pub, but perhaps that was another time. It's so hard to remember because that first visit was overwhelming in so many different ways. I'd finally done it. I'd gone somewhere and I'd spent some time around other LGBT people, and that felt exciting, courageous, something to be celebrated. But I hadn't talked to anyone, apart from my very patient friend, and I couldn't yet see how I fitted in here, or how pubs like this would become such a central part of my life. And most of all, I was frightened.
The first times I went to some gay pubs, I was probably about 17, about 17. And I went to one which is in Camden Town, where I live, called the Black Cap. And I went in there as a very nervous 17-year-old, at a time when, you know, you had to be 18 to go into a pub anyway. I was also a punky-looking kid, so I stood out. And most of the audience there weren't as punky as me, so I stood out, and I was nervous anyway. You know, in these days, and we're talking, you know, this is the late 70s, to be seen to walk into a known gay pub was something that was quite nerve-wracking, especially if you were as young and as nervous as I was. So I went a couple of times. I didn't speak to anybody. I just gawped at everything, and I remember thinking, how am I going to make this work? How is this going to, you know, how am I going to find a place for me here? And it took quite a while. I was also, you've got to remember, I was still part of the, you know, going out to punk gigs, and I had friends on the punk scene, which was great. So I was used to going out and hanging out with people and had a social circle. But I didn't have, you know, a gay circle at this time. And that took quite a long time for me to find others like myself. Invariably, you know, we eventually found each other. This is sort of getting into my 20s. And that's when we started to find each other.
That's Joe Pop, a regular on the London LGBT pub scene since the 1970s and DJ at Bar Whatever since 2007. Radio broadcaster and founder of Brighton Gin, Kathy Caton, also chose Camden's Black Cap as the first place to dip her toe in the water of queer nightlife.
Yeah, so I am somebody who had the extreme misfortune to be at school during Section 28 and the shadows of it. And that had a really lasting legacy on me that actually I'm probably still trying to unpack some of that stuff now. But certainly it meant that I had a lot of internalised homophobia. I'd came out very late when I eventually came out. I came out once and went back in again. But this is long enough ago that this is last century, and I was living in Camden, which is where the now deceased Black Cap is. And I don't know how many times I tried to go through the front door of this place. But I found it absolutely terrifying to do. And I don't know. I think there was so much fear and shame and the whole thing. And actually, of course, what happened was when I pitched up and got in, no one paid the blindest bit of notice at all because they're watching the cabaret and flirting and chatting and having a drink. But I still found it completely terrifying and legged it after my little half lager. It's a lifetime ago. I cringe still though.
So I wasn't alone in responding with fear and perhaps a little bit of shame to my first experience of an LGBT pub. But why? Well, Kathy hinted at part of the reason when she mentioned Section 28, a hateful piece of legislation part of the Local Government Act of 1988 that sought to prohibit the promotion of homosexuality by local authorities. The Prime Minister of the time, Margaret Thatcher, famously said, "Children who need to be taught to respect traditional moral values are being taught they have an inalienable right to be gay," which in her mind was completely unacceptable. This legislation was in force until 2003, giving rise to a generation of young people, myself included, who set out into adult life and the world of gay pubs, wondering if what we were doing was right. But of course, Section 28 isn't the only anti-gay legislation that's ever existed in the UK. And in order to fully understand LGBT pubs and why the history of them is often so lost to the past, we really need to understand the climate in which they exist. So it's time for a quick history lesson. But it's the kind of history they never taught you in school. The 1533 Buggery Act, passed during the reign of Henry VIII, was the first piece of legislation in the UK to target homosexuality. It made anal intercourse illegal and punishable by death. In 1861, the Offences Against the Person Act reduced that punishment from death to imprisonment. But just 4 years later, the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1885, the so-called Blackmailer's Charter, made any male homosexual act illegal, whether or not anyone witnessed it. Sometimes just a love letter between two men was enough to lead to prosecution. It wasn't until 1967 that this law was repealed. Some hail this as the moment that homosexuality was made legal in the UK, but although it certainly was progress, in reality, it only partially decriminalised gay lives. For a start, the 1967 reforms applied only to England and Wales and weren't extended to Scotland until 1980 or to Northern Ireland until 1982. They also didn't apply to gay people in the military or the Merchant Navy. Also, the law set the age of consent at 21 for sex between men, as opposed to 16 for heterosexual sex, and the punishment for a man over 21 having non-anal sex with a man aged between 16 and 21 was actually increased. Gay bars, pubs and clubs continued to be raided by the police, and gay men and some lesbians were arrested for as little as kissing, cuddling or demonstrating affection in public well into the 1990s. In addition, it wasn't until 2003 that it became illegal to discriminate against lesbian, gay and bisexual people in the workplace. Until then, people could be refused jobs or sacked just because of their sexuality. And right up until 2007, it was perfectly legal to refuse lesbian, gay and bisexual people goods and services, including, for example, a drink in a pub. It doesn't actually feel like that long ago that I would arrive at unfamiliar pubs, wondering if I'd get served. And I have a number of friends who suffered the shame of being asked to leave pubs where they were not welcome because they were in a family-friendly venue. And of course, history has a habit of sometimes repeating itself, and for me, the current anti-trans rhetoric echoes much of the moral panic about lesbian and gay people used in the time of Section 28. And until trans and non-binary people are fully protected in legislation, the LGBT community will continue to sometimes feel under attack. And the result of all this is that when we talk about the history of queer pubs, we're talking about much more than just buildings and the people who drank in them. We're talking about oppression, prejudice, fear, and secrecy. But running through this history is passion, in all its many glorious, overwhelming, and beautiful forms. Relatively little is known of where LGBT people used to meet and drink and connect with each other in previous centuries. But meet together they did. From the molly houses of the 18th century to the short-lived Cave of the Golden Calf in London's West End, an avant-garde haven for wealthy bohemians and a place widely credited with the title of Britain's first gay pub, LGBT people have met and fell in love with each other. Here's Brighton-based queer historian Alf Lefloic.
Well, in previous centuries, people would always find a way to meet, and it would often be around socialising and alcohol. For example, the kind of private drinking clubs in London in the turn of the century and the 20s and 30s, there was a massive boom in London. Theatre bars, places like the Colonnade in New Road in Brighton, that's an example of, you know, it's not a gay bar, but it's a theatre bar, and because of that it has a certain clientele. Then there'd be the example of back rooms in straight pubs. One example of that in Brighton would be the back bar of the Iron Duke in Waterloo Street, I think in the 90s and noughties. I think it was called the Triangle Bar. They started advertising the back bar as a gay bar, even though the front was, you know, straight. Then there's, you know, places like tea rooms and clubs.
For obvious reasons, until recently, the idea of a gay pub, in terms of the traditional pubs we know and love, was highly unusual. LGBT people had to meet in subterranean bars, back rooms, supper clubs, secret venues and private members' clubs, where the emphasis was always on safety. Writer Jill Gardner remembers her first time in an LGBT venue.
Well, the first time I went to a gay club was Caves in Silwood Street in Brighton in 1984, which was again in a basement. They so often were in basements, so you felt you were kind of a bit out of the way. And although that's kind of, you know, being behind this closed door and having to rap on the door and somebody opening the grill and then, you know, seeing who you were and that you were, it was okay to let you in, all that was in some ways a bit intimidating. But it was also, once you were actually behind the door, you felt really special. You know, you felt like you were this kind of, you'd made it finally into a place where you could meet people like you. You know, you weren't just sort of sitting in your bedroom writing poetry about some woman who didn't fancy you. You were actually in a club with all these other people you could talk to and be open with about it. And also, you know, you might actually meet someone and could at least dance with somebody. Well, at Caves, you knocked on the door, somebody opened a grill and then checked you out and then let you in. The signing in book, well, the first time I went there, I just put my own name because I didn't know any better. But then somebody told me that the police got to see these books, and I was terrified because I was in teaching and I didn't, you know, I really was not keen for my employers to know about my sexuality, because it was perfectly legal to sack someone purely for being gay until 2003. So, you know, you had to be very careful. So ever after that, when I went to gay clubs, I used to give a false name. But the trouble was I couldn't always remember which name I'd used.
Tracing the history of lesbian pubs is further complicated by the fact that it hasn't always been socially acceptable for women to go to pubs, especially without men. But in the aftermath of World War II, some women found themselves with disposable income, away from the constraints of their family homes, and finally able to explore what the cities had to offer, including a burgeoning, but underground, lesbian scene. Jill is the author of a book, From the Closet to the Screen, which documents the history of the Gateways Club. a place that by the time it closed in 1985 was the longest-running lesbian venue in the world. The Gateways achieved both notoriety and fame through the song Green Door, first made famous by Frankie Vaughan and then later recorded by The Cramps and also Shaken Stevens, and through the film The Killing of Sister George, starring Beryl Reid and Susanna York, which featured a scene filmed inside the club.
Well, it was in Chelsea. The entrance was in Bramerton Street. It was in a basement. It seems to have been opened by 1931, as far as I could find out. But it started as an arty bohemian club, so it was frequented by a lot of Chelsea artists. And lesbians found that they were welcome there. There was one particularly important occasion when Ted Ware, who owned it by 1943, had a male customer who was hassling a couple of the gay women there, because gay service women were going there during the war, and gay women apparently from Chelsea were going there in the 30s before the war. On one occasion, there was a straight man hassling a couple of the lesbians, and Ted threw him out. He didn't throw them out, and so word got round, you know, that you, it was safe to be yourself there, and that he, you know, he was very happy with his gay women as his clientele. It didn't become women only until 1967, but it was overwhelmingly frequented by women increasingly in the 40s, late 40s, 50s, and 60s. Because they felt it was, they often said that, you know, the only place they could go, by which they meant not that it was the only venue where, you know, you could ever dance with your girlfriend, because there would be, you know, odd nights at different other venues, but the Gateways was open every night. The iconic experience of going there is you had to knock on the door, first of all, to get entry. Someone would open a grill and just ask you, are you a member? And if you weren't a member, you had to really talk your way in, or you might not be allowed in at all. Someone had to sign you in if it was your first visit. But once you were in there, you walked down the stairs and all eyes turned to you as you were going down the stairs, sizing you up. You know, that could be quite an intimidating experience, especially the first time, but also quite a thrill. You've got all these women looking at you and you've come to meet other gay women. You know, that was quite a moment. But I think what was just so exciting about it was just liberating to be able to go into a space where you could be yourself and not be hassled by straight men, and just, you know, meet other women like you. You know, obviously if you were looking for a girlfriend or if it was your first time ever going to a gay venue, then it was an opportunity to try and meet people. I mean, I can't say myself I've never really made a close friendship from a gay club, but people did get into relationships. You know, they would, eyes would meet across the room, and if two women fancied each other, they'd end up dancing together, and then that might sometimes lead to going home together, even on the first date, because, you know, first night, because how else did you meet people? It was quite tough at the time.
The Gateways had a reputation as a place where lesbian butch femme culture thrived. And some even talk about there being a strict dress code.
There was a certain amount of pressure in the 60s to be one or the other, but there were equally quite a lot of women who never felt they were particularly one or the other, and a lot of unisex people unisex dress in the, particularly by the mid to late 60s. So, I mean, it was a place where if you wanted to go in a suit and tie or in a frock, you know, arm in arm, you could. But equally, you could go there dressed in a kind of unisex way, and, you know, you might be asked in the early 60s what, you know, which you were. But if you, you know, you could find a way of still being yourself.
But of course, however they chose to dress, women took a risk each time they went to the Gateways.
Well, the thing was that you were at risk if you were spotted and outed as being gay, you know, which you could be if you went to a pub with your girlfriend and you were holding hands or something. You know, someone could make a complaint, or, you know, or if you were spotted by somebody that you worked with, say, the things you risked were losing your job, which did happen to some people. It certainly happened to someone who was in The Killing of Sister George. You could lose your flat if your landlord or landlady found out. And there were quite a lot of women who were married with children who were going down to the gateways, you know, because a lot of young women got married in the 50s and 60s, you know, before they really realised or before they could think of another way of living, before they realised they could live a gay lifestyle. And invariably, lesbians lost custody of their children if there were divorce cases. So you could be risking losing your job, your children, and even your home as well, just by setting foot in a gay venue or being identified coming out of one.
So, like many LGBT people have been over the years, you had to be pretty brave to go to the gateways.
It was brave because, you know, there was always a slight risk that you might bump into someone who knew you. There were rumours about, you know, undercover police and things like that. There was a lot of fear. Yeah, well, it did involve bravery, but if you were going to live a life, if you were ever going to meet friends who were also gay or a partner, you know, you had to go somewhere to find people.
And Jill's right. For many, it's a risk that's worth taking. And lots of people, including myself, have taken the risk to walk into an LGBT venue over the years. After all, in the pre-internet times in which I came of age, there were very few other ways to meet people. When I was growing up, I didn't know one other LGBT person. None of my immediate friends or family were gay. And all I saw on TV was the growing horror of AIDS and the almost universal condemnation of the lesbians living at Greenham Common. As I came to terms with being a lesbian in my late teens, I barely had the words to describe it, and I certainly didn't know how to contact other people like me. Queer pubs were an absolute lifeline, because if I'd stayed in my bedroom writing poetry, as Jill suggested, I simply wouldn't have made any friends or met any partners, and I wouldn't have had nearly so much fun. Here's Kathy Caton again.
My current partner is somebody who I met in the pub, and actually thinking about it, so was my previous one. In a different pub, but you know that those, they're just yeah, the chances to go and meet people and connect with people are made much easier in a pub. Also, having a pint or two definitely helps take the edge off things and can, you know, eases those social interactions and increases our chances of meeting people, I suppose, and having a chat at the bar to someone. You never know who you're going to meet. They might be an idiot. They might also be your next great love, or both.
So having venues that are not necessarily advertised as completely queer but are queer friendly enables you to feel a lot safer, especially in the past, but still today, a lot safer in doing what people do in pubs, which is talk to their friends, but also, you know, catch the eye of a stranger. I've had straight friends, this is kind of in the 90s, I've had straight friends complain to me about all the snogging and touching that sometimes goes on in kind of gay venues. And initially I saw their point, and then after a while I just thought, you don't really realise your privilege of being able to do those things, you know, hold someone's hand, snog them. You don't realise the privilege of being able to do those things in a pub or on any street corner without ending up in hospital.
That was historian Alf Lefloic, and he makes an important point. When you're unable to show affection to your partner in other public spaces due to fear of harassment or physical violence, pubs and bars become even more central to your life. I'm going to talk more about pubs as places of safety in episode 2 of Passion, Pride and Protest. But needless to say, for certain communities within the LGBT umbrella, particularly those communities on the receiving end of transphobia or racism in addition to homophobia, safety is even harder to come by. And as with all history, the history of LGBT pubs is often written by the dominant group. Oluwatayo Adewola, writer, critic and poet.
Specifically with like black queer things, I think there has been a thing where certain narratives get elevated. The predominant queer stories are almost always the white ones, despite the fact that that's not the reality when you look at the past.
Oluwatayo wrote a recent article for Galdem magazine about Pearl's Bar, another subterranean bar almost lost within the mists of time.
Pearl Arcock was this like really cool lady in Brixton, and so she did a lot of things, but one of the things that she's most prominent for is running this Shabeen, otherwise known as like a bar without a license, underneath her women's clothing shop in like the mid to late 70s. So this was this place on 106 Railton Road, and predominantly had like black gay men. There were some white gay men from the gay squat, which is further up the road, but it was kind of this like really cool space in this very specific period of time, which is really unique both in terms of the time period and in terms of the specific bar itself. People would come from all over the place because it was one of the few safe spaces, particularly for black gay men, to kind of be together and to just be around other people like them. From what I've heard, it's like, it was almost like so interesting and like unique to see this many black gay men together in one space and see them like close to each other and with each other in a way that you weren't really seeing in basically anywhere else. And it was, from what I've heard, it like it wasn't like the biggest space or the most like fancy, but it was definitely like, in terms of its emotional effect, in terms of its cultural impact, it was a real important space for these very specific people and really was kind of key to a certain part of all their lives.
And what about the future? With the growth of the internet and the exponential rise of online dating apps, are pubs still the place where LGBT people meet their partners?
I know people meeting all the time in bars and clubs, but I don't think that that's so important anymore, because we're looking at an era where there was no internet, you know, no dating apps or, you know, dating even, you know, so it really was the only place you could meet people.
Linda Riley, founder of Lesbian Visibility Week and publisher of Diva Magazine, the leading magazine across Europe for LGBTQI women.
But if you're asking me, is it important to have LGBT bars now to meet a prospective partner? I would say the answer was definitely no, because of the changing times. You know, I could probably get on an app right now and, or you know, go on Diva Community on Facebook and say I'm single and hopefully get some responses. Do you know what I mean? It's just different ways of meeting people.
And many agree with Linda. Here's Kathy Caton again.
You know, I'm not massively au fait with the dating apps. I have to say, I've had a few ill-advised flim-flams around with them. But I think that you can really see the correlation between the ease and accessibility of using a dating app in your back pocket versus going into a space. When you go into a space, maybe to go and meet someone on a date, you know, you're committing yourself to it. You can't just suddenly swipe left or right or the appropriate direction to just, you know, get out of that situation. I think that, but I think you can really see, actually, particularly in pubs and bars, particularly that are very gay male focused, I think you can definitely see the effect that the apps have had on them, whether it's them being much, much quieter spaces, or the fact that when you go in, everyone's on their phone and Grindr's pinging every 2 seconds. Like I say, I'm not the Grindr expert, but I have had a few nights in pubs with people going, why am I even here? Get off your phones, guys, for a second.
It would seem that online dating and the connectivity that comes with the internet is changing the way LGBT people use pubs. LGBT pubs, like mainstream pubs, have been declining in numbers over recent years, and I'll explore that in a bit more depth in episode 3 of Passion, Pride and Protest. However, Professor Ben Kampkin and his team at UCL Urban Laboratory at University College London looked into whether one of the reasons for these closures was the rise in people online dating rather than meeting face to face.
When we looked at the evidence, we were quite unsatisfied by the type of arguments that were circulating and the press about why places were closing. So one of the classic arguments was, well, these spaces are not needed anymore, or everything's gone online, those kinds of things. And although there's an element of truth in some of those arguments, so, you know, online apps, those kinds of ways of networking have become more important, but they haven't replaced the need for or the qualities of physical spaces.
And Amy LeMay, London's Night Czar, who together with the Mayor of London co-commissioned Professor Kampkin's research, is optimistic.
The rise of online dating has impacted LGBTQ+ venues. But interestingly, in the research that UCL and Ben Kampkin did, This did not come out as one of the reasons why venues are closing, because we are inherently social beings. There's always going to be a need for like-minded people to have a safe space where they can meet and enjoy shared experiences. Streaming has changed the way we consume music, but it doesn't mean that we love music any less or that we don't want to go to a live music venue and see a show. In fact, our spaces are even more important for us, so we have places to meet each other safely and amongst people that are like-minded.
So perhaps LGBT pubs, bars, and clubs will continue to play the role they've played for more than a century. That of a place where we can meet people like us, make friends, fall in and out of love, and begin to experience true passion. Passion, Pride and Protest was produced and presented by Emma Inch. If you've not already done so, catch up with episode 2, Pride, and episode 3, Protest, on the Learn and Discover pages of the Camera website.